Professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
I'm Jim Meadows, AM 580 News. The Power Hour is coming. WillPledge.org.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Kraner Center for the Performing Arts, presenting a global mix of dance during the 2007-2008 season featuring Tango Buenos Aires, Georgian State Dance Company, Merce Cunningham Dance Company, and St. Petersburg Ballet Theater. More information is available at KranerCenter.com.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, the man, David Inge. At the controls, Jason Croft, and our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. And very glad you are listening today. We've all heard lots about the communications revolution and the explosion of media just about everywhere. Seems like technology is about to give us endless freedom and choice, right? Unfortunately, as we like to say around here, it's a little more complicated than that. For one thing, technology doesn't determine how we choose to use it, and as citizens and consumers, we might choose among wildly different paths. For another thing, we might not get to choose how to use new media technology at all because of public policy decisions now being made that set up the ground rules. For example, the issue of net neutrality might get decided in a way that gives corporate media control of who gets how much bandwidth on the internet. Given the growing importance of internet access for just about everything, it's kind of an important policy issue, what we might call a critical juncture in the future of media. You might not have heard much about net neutrality or about other policy issues being debated now that will determine what choices we have as media citizens and consumers. So we'll focus on that during this hour of Focus 580 with a scholar who makes that his main concern. Robert McChesney is the Gutskell Endowed Professor. Did I say that right?
I have no idea. It's impossible to pronounce.
Thank you. Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He is the president and co-founder of Free Press, a national media reform organization. He is also the author of numerous books on the history of media and democracy, including the classic text Telecommunications, Mass Media and Democracy, The Battle for the Control of U.S. Broadcasting, 1928 to 1935, also, Corporate Media and the Threat to Democracy with Edward Herman, The Global Media, The New Missionaries of Corporate Capitalism, easy for me to say, and the multiple award-winning Rich Media, Poor Democracy, Communication Politics in Dubious Times, and other books as well, which, you know, if we're going to have time for a conversation, we'll have to mention another time. Bob McChesney is also, of course, the host of a little show here on WILL we call Media Matters. Airs Sunday at 1 p.m. He is the host of that show, and he's the guest on ours this morning. So we're glad to have him with us.
My pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Also, I want to mention that for the listeners during this hour, we welcome you into the conversation. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. And during this hour, we'll talk with Bob McChesney about his latest book, I forgot to mention that, Communication Revolution, Critical Junctures, and the Future of Media, just published or about to be published.
Yeah, it's officially coming out October 1st.
Right, by the New Press. So thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Let's talk about, to start, sort of the upside of things, the promise of the communication revolution, to sort of lay out what kind of things are at stake. What can and should media do for us?
Well, you know, if you look at the founders of the Republic in the United States, the premise of our Constitution and of self-government is that you have a viable press system that informs people, engages them, draws them into public life so they can govern their own lives. That without information, the constitutional system doesn't work, without citizens knowing what's going on. And at the very least, just the starting point, what we have with these technologies and the communication revolution is a manner to create a communication system that can accomplish those ends far less expensively. I mean, it was a very difficult thing to imagine in 1792 when you have to build a post office and roads to get people to communicate. And then you have to have people who are literate and you've got to publish papers and the expenses are great. And now we're in a situation where we can collapse time and space into a nanosecond, into an inch. You know, global transmission of virtually anything will be possible in the near future. So we have the capacity now, the economic capacity and technological capacity to shrink the world and to give us the tools to govern our lives in a way that has never really existed before. And that's the foundation of having genuine self-government.
Yeah. And it seems that, you know, I'm into the internet, you know that,
yeah.
Right? It's now possible to learn about so much more than it ever was before. But not only to learn about, to get information, to consume information, but to actually publish, to be a publisher yourself. And maybe not on the same scale as the New York Times or
No, I mean, what's revolutionary about the internet, among other things, is that it makes it doesn't just revolutionize being a consumer, access to material. It revolutionizes being a producer. And people inexpensively being able to participate as viable players, producing stuff. So it's a two-way flow, not a one-way flow. And I think that's what everyone gets excited about with the internet. That's the promise it holds. But, you know, the internet and the digital revolution do not solve our problems. It's not like, okay, now we can go back to sleep, go back to the couch, everything's taken care of. Because, you know, there are policy decisions that will shape the technology, shape the systems that deploy the technology. We'll go a long way to see whether or not that promise comes about. And even if we have a ubiquitous internet with broadband and everyone's got it, there's no digital divide. All of those are enormous ifs, by the way, that we're fighting on right now. Even if we got all those, there's still fundamental questions that we need to discuss and deal with as a policy. For starters, we need to have journalism in our society. Right now, journalism in the United States is in a deep crisis. This is recognized in newsrooms across the country. The commercial pressures on owners of news media are such that we're seeing, you know, the resources going to journalism are falling behind. There's fewer and fewer journalists. The business model of conventional journalism is failing, partially due to the internet, but it really preceded that. It goes back into the 80s when we saw this really launching. In the early 90s, it was already crystal clear. So just having the internet doesn't solve the problem of journalism. We need coherent, well-paid journalists in competing newsrooms covering their communities, covering the nation, covering the world. That's going to require policies. That's not going to magically happen because people can't use the internet. You know, if someone works all day, you know, and they've got a job like you do, or any of the listeners here has a job, you go home, you make dinner for your family, you do your dishes, you clean your house up, you put your kids to bed, then you sit down at your blog and you're going to blog on North Korean relations. It's probably going to be pretty lousy because you don't really have the time to know much about North Korea. You depend on someone actually having time to do journalism in North Korea that you can then use their stuff to riff off of, like a jazz musician doing a solo on someone's melody. But you've got to have the melody in the first place. And that doesn't come magically with the internet. That doesn't create the institutions or resources to do journalism. That's a fundamental social problem our society has to face up to that technology won't solve. And the one thing we do know is that the commercial system won't solve it either. The commercial system is the part of the problem, a big part of the problem. It basically has lost interest in journalism as we've known it traditionally. The second area where the technology won't really solve our problems for us is with hyper-commercialism. One of the great trends in our society that's been ongoing for 100 years, but it's really accelerated in the past decade, has been the spread of marketing, commercialism, advertising, branding, whatever you want to call it, into every nook and cranny of our lives. There's simply, you know, men's room stalls, I mean, have it. Everywhere you go, you're getting hit with an advertisement for this or that. And, you know, if all the internet in the final analysis does is it opens up a conduit for Madison Avenue and Wall Street into the DNA of our lives so that it's just hardwired into us, we might regret the day the computer was invented. I think, you know, that will not we need to have policies to sort of wall off and protect non-commercial spaces, the integrity of non-commercial institutions. And in particular, the real crisis, the immediate crisis, but not the only one, is childhood. Because in the United States today, children are facing an onslaught of some of the most sophisticated marketing that the world's ever seen. It's the highest form of propaganda the world's ever seen, hitting kids at the very earliest ages now. With implications for our culture and for the happiness and the lives of our children, that the range of debate extends from those who say this might be a problem to those who say this is going to be an absolute crisis. There's no one on earth saying, oh, this is going to be great. It's wonderful that kids at age five know 200 corporate logos or can differentiate between a bunch of advertising jingles. It's really a great education we're doing for kids.
We're talking this morning with Bob McChesney about his latest book, Communication Revolution, Critical Junctures in the Future of Media, about to be published by the New Press, I believe October 1st, so coming out very soon. I just got an advertisement from Amazon.com targeting me, you know, letting me know about the book. And so if you want to look for that, you should be able to see that soon. And if you want to join our conversation, you can do so by calling us here on the air, 217-333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-9455. The subtitle of your book is Critical Junctures in the Future of Media. What do you mean by a critical juncture?
Yeah, and the starting point to understand is our media system in the United States is a profit-driven system, but it's not a free market system. I mean, it's clearly run to make as much money as possible for the handful of owners that dominate it, or the small owners that try to get into it. But it's not a free market system. It's based on enormous subsidies and monopoly licenses that almost all the media benefit by. Monopoly licenses for free to radio and televisions, lucrative radio and television channels. Monopoly licenses for telephone and cable and satellite systems. You're the only one who gets to use them, generally at no charge. Copyright, which is nothing more than a government-created artificial monopoly to protect a content provider from market competition, an enormous subsidy that's created by the government for media industries. The list goes on and on. So our media system is the result of policies and subsidies. It's created by the government. It's been that way from the beginning, and I'm not opposed to that. I mean, the founders of the Republic, particularly Madison and Jefferson, were obsessed with putting into place subsidies, printing and postal subsidies, that would spawn a rich, vibrant print culture. They said, we can't have a democracy, we can't have the Constitution work without that. The problem we face in the United States is that over time, those policies have been made increasingly behind closed doors by very powerful commercial interests with no public awareness, no press coverage. So we're told it's a free market system when, in fact, behind closed doors, they're getting politicians to give them all the goodies. And the notion of critical junctures is simply this. You look at historically at how our media system develops, and there are clearly dramatic changes over time. There's new media that emerge. There's new systems that emerge. How do we explain those changes? How do we explain the moment we're in right now? And the idea of critical junctures is that, in general, our media system's fairly static. It doesn't change much. Its institutions are put in place, like commercial broadcasting, and they go on for generations or two. And you can't really get off that path, even though there are policies that create it. The policies are pretty strongly reinforced by the structures you've created. But historically, there are moments in which society has a chance to radically recreate its media system. These are called critical junctures. They tend to happen at moments when you have a radical new technology that really upsets the apple cart of the existing media, like the telegraph or radio broadcasting or now the internet, or when you have, and also when you have a period in which the content of the media is highly questioned by much of society. In the progressive era, for example, 100 years ago, journalism was in deep scandalous crisis with sensationalism and partisanship and bribery. And it led to the formation of professional journalism as a result of that. And then the third factor that contributes to a critical juncture is when you have a broader period of social upheaval, when all the institutions in society are subject to a more close scrutiny, more critical review than they would be in normal times. So the classic critical juncture in that sense, the classic moment of upheaval comes when you have a constitutional convention, and actually the rule book for society is being written. So that was the first one we had. And that's when we came up with a number of policies that created our media system. We've also had,
like, copyright, for example.
Copyrights in the Constitution,
yeah,
as well.
Exactly.
And, you know, we've had a number of crucial media critical junctures throughout our history. I think the one I wrote about that's probably the most important is when radio broadcasting came along. And there was no understanding, how do you organize this industry? It was a public decision. And most countries in the world decided that it should be, since there were only a handful of channels available to any country, it should be run by the government or some nonprofit body without advertising to serve the entire community. In the United States, powerful commercial interests basically got the airwaves and then built a law to protect their control over it. And there was tremendous opposition to it by a heterogeneous group of Americans in their late 1920s and 1930s. Yeah, I won't keep you in suspense. They failed. But they tried very hard, and they had more success than one might imagine to raise this as an issue and say, this is not a really rational way for a society to go to organize such a fundamental medium. And what happened in the early 1930s is, once the commercial interests won, they put us on a path. We left that critical juncture where that system was very strong. And now it's again being threatened and challenged. We're in another critical juncture because, first and foremost, the digital communication technologies are really undermining the business model of these companies in all media, on one hand. Secondly, due to commercial pressures, the content, especially the journalism, but not exclusively the journalism, of these companies is now under public criticism to a much greater extent than ever before, or certainly in recent times, and much more than any time since the 1930s or 40s at least. And then third, the real question, and this is the kicker, is, you know, whether, you know, whether we're going to have that sort of broad moment of public transformation and public involvement in politics like we've had in the New Deal, in the 1960s, the progressive era, that this country tends to have every two generations or so, in which people get together and organize and say, you know, the way things are working here isn't right. There's too much inequality. There's way too much corruption. We've got to reshuffle the deck of how our society works. And that's unclear whether we're going to have one of those. I think, personally, we're long overdue for one of those. I think if you look by historical standards at inequality, at corruption, and you compare it to what predated the 60s, or certainly the New Deal or the Progressive Era, or Jacksonian democracy, we're long overdue now for sort of a correction to right the ship. And if we have one of those, if we enter a period of popular politics, increased popular politics, then I think this critical juncture for media opens up a whole range of alternatives for building a democratic, popular media system that's not even on the table now. If we don't have one of those, we're still going to have a fight over it, but it's going to be a narrower fight.
We have a couple calls to include in our conversation. Let's do that. Let me mention again our guest, Bob McChesney, during this hour, Focus 580. His new book, Communication Revolution, Critical Junctures and the Future of Media, published on October 1st, coming up by the New Press. If you would like to join our conversation, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Urbana, line number two. Good morning. Hello? Is there a caller there?
Hello?
Yes, okay, we got you now.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very impressed with what you've been saying, and I really agree with you. And I find, at first, when you were talking about copyright, I thought, this guy doesn't like copyrights, and then you said, no, I'm for them. But I've always discovered, see, I had a business where I made copyrighted material, and I've always discovered that people are, you know, they don't like copyrights unless they ever own one. So, but I was going to ask you about this democratization of the internet, and I think it's an interesting subject. I think it's, you're right, it's in its formative stages. It's not sure where it's going. But also, I've always been really skeptical about this situation because of the fact that you have an inundation of, let's say, opinion, or everybody's got their opinion, and so they can put it up on these web pages and all this stuff, so you basically have no way to access, you know, the innumerable amount of quantity of this data. So it may have this swing towards this democratization and this vast compendium of information. Then it may drop back down to where there's only a few trusted people. But I'm suspect and cynical about the audience, this participation, because I'm not quite sure if there's enough skepticism about source. And I wanted to interject one thing about Wikipedia, there was a guy on yesterday, and that. There's a man, a software engineer, who wrote a reverse algorithm which allows you to look at the source of the changes. Found out that most of the corporate changes were made by the companies themselves, you know, eradicating all the negative data that they didn't like. And through his algorithm, if you go to his site, you can actually go to his site, and you can actually follow these back to the source of the changes. And I found that's the democratization I'm looking for. But I just want to know what your opinion is on that. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, thank you very much for the call. Let me say something about copyright, because that is a very important issue, and it becomes a much more important issue in the coming era than it's ever been. Copyright was once in the field of communication, sort of like the area you studied if you were like the most boring person on earth. That seemed like so dry, looking at copyright law. Now it's really maybe the sexiest issue in communication studies and policy studies. And the caller's right, I'm not opposed to copyright. Copyright recognizes the fact that media industries are unlike other industries and that they're non-rivalrous, meaning, you know, if I eat a hamburger for lunch, in my case a vegetarian hamburger, you can't eat it, Jack. Only one person can consume it. It's a rivalrous product. Or if I own a car and drive it, you can't drive the same car simultaneously. Media products aren't the same way. I can listen to a great CD of music, and you can listen to the same music, and it won't affect my quality. I'll enjoy it. And it won't detract from my ability or read the same book. Media can be spread. It's non-rivalrous. And multiple people can use the same product without affecting the other person. It doesn't have the same scarcity built into it that traditional goods and services do. And because of that, the problem for media has always been from the beginning. If someone writes a book and other people can publish the book and doesn't give the author any money for it, that's a free market. The price of the book comes way down, but the author won't make any money off it, so they'll want to write more books. So it was in society's interest to give them a monopoly privilege, copyright. I hear the band tuning up. Sorry about that. I of all people, should know to turn my cell phone off when I come to a radio show.
Never a dull moment.
Never okay. A dull moment.
That's right.
And I've got one of these. This is appropriate for this show. I've got a loaner cell phone from one of these cell phone companies, and it's like from Night at the Roxbury, so it's like 1997, so it barely works, and I can't, it's tough to even turn on and off. But anyway, going back to copyright, so copyright's a necessary evil. We needed the idea in the Constitution was if you give an author a certain period of time where they have monopoly privilege to their book, they'll make enough money on it, and then they can have incentive to write more books.
Right.
And then after 14 years, it would go into the public domain, and then anyone could publish it. The price would come down. It would be spread. So it would be a win-win. And the founders regarded copyright as a tax on knowledge, a necessary evil. They didn't like it, but they said you have to have it if you want to give – because of the way media industries work, you had to do that to protect the monopoly rights. And what's happened with copyright over the years, especially in the last 50 years, is that the copyright has been extended now, so it's basically indefinite. It's 95 years past the for copyright, 70 years past the death of an author for my books that I keep copyright, well beyond what the founders intended and well beyond what's necessary to meet that principle of giving an author incentive. And it's been extended because these commercial lobbies have all the leverage and power, and they've extended it. And that becomes a real barrier in the Internet. As anyone who goes on the Internet and tries to work with material that's copywritten knows, you know, you get threatened by lawyers. I mean, it really puts barriers on the free flow of information, which is why copyright law is going to be one of the crucial laws that will determine just how open the Internet's going to be and our digital communication system's going to be. And it's the one area where the policymaking has been as corrupt as humanly imaginable. I mean, it's really been, on one side, the most powerful lobbyists in the world who floss their teeth with the politicians. On the other side, a bunch of librarians who are doing the best they can, but they're in a whole different league. They're in an ocean of sharks, and they're in a paddle boat. So that's copyright. And then that's the second point on democratization of the Internet. You know, I think I agree with him. I think there are real concerns there, and I think that's why what's imperative for us as societies, we've got to come up with ways to create institutions and organizations that are going to spawn quality content on the Internet using digital technology, especially journalism. And there's no easy way to do that, but one of the sure ways to do it, and I think one of the ways that now becoming clear is, you know, this is not meant to be self-serving, even though I'm on WILL and we're always looking for support here, but back in the 80s and 90s, especially in the 90s, as the Internet came along and emerged, the World Wide Web, people said, we aren't going to need public broadcasting anymore. And that day has passed. Now we've got 5,000 TV channels and websites, and we've got Bravo and all these people doing cultural stuff. Who needs public broadcasting anymore? There are too many options in the market. And I think what we're learning now is quite the opposite, that the need for non-commercial, non-profit institutions covering their communities, doing public affairs has never been greater, being well-supported. And I think the case for public media, and I use the term media because I think eventually what we're doing here is going to all be online.
I agree.
So the term broadcasting is antiquated. But public media has never been stronger. And I think we're going to see in this country as a result, due to political organizing and popular pressure, a real increase of commitment of resources to local, nonprofit, non-commercial stations, both NPR and community stations in the next decade.
Well, I can hope so, certainly, speaking for myself. But let's go on and talk with some other, more callers and let them speak. We have someone next in Champaign, line number 3. Good morning.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hello.
I listen to Mr. McChesney's show every week. I get a real kick out of it.
Well, thank you.
I would say that we are currently in a period of popular media, and I'll give one example. The Rush Limbaugh show draws 20 million viewers a week. He's not a big corporation. He's one guy with a small staff who puts out content that 20 million people a week want to listen to. Radio stations then buy that content because they know that they can get advertisers because people will listen to it. I would suggest that public radio, and really all public media, is a tiny backwater compared to the commercial, that serves a tiny, tiny group of people compared to commercial, and that it would never stand on its own without subsidy. The second point I was going to make is that technology, like the Internet, democratizes things. It used to be to make $1 billion, you had to be a giant corporation. But in the early 90s, a guy with an idea who could get access to capital could become a billionaire.
Okie dokie, you want me to comment on those?
Please do.
I'd be glad to. Well, the only on the Rush Limbaugh point, it's not just NPR that gets a subsidy. All those stations that carry Rush Limbaugh get a monopoly franchise to a very scarce and lucrative license in their community at no charge from the federal government. That is an indirect subsidy worth a ton of money. that any of us would like to have. So these are not free market companies that started in the garage and went out and won in the free marketplace. Their first thing they had to do is get the politicians to give them this monopoly license over anyone else. So we have a stake in the commercial system as much as we do the non-commercial. We're bankrolling the whole system, not just the NPR. And the NPR subsidy, or the public subsidy for community stations, is very small relative to the budget of these stations. So it's not not to disagree with maybe the tenor of your point, but just to be with factual clarity on the point of subsidy. Now, the second point about technology democratizing things, there's an element of truth to that, obviously. And there were companies that came along that didn't exist that became huge thanks to new technologies. That's not really a new thing. We've had that throughout capitalism, the history of capitalism. There have been great fortunes in new industries that come along, oftentimes with new technologies. But I don't think, and I think it's interesting you said it back in the 90s. That's a striking way to frame it, because I think the economic evidence is that now, increasingly, that the internet and digital technologies have what are called strong network effects, which really by network effects, I mean strongly encourage monopoly and concentration. For example, one might think that thanks to the internet, we'd have 300 competitive book-selling companies where you go buy books online. Because anyone can start a book-selling company. You don't need anyone's permission. It doesn't cost any capital, really, to set up your website. Very little to start competing with Amazon. But what happened is Amazon basically has the game largely to themselves because of network effects. They've gotten so big with so much scale that they can have a much broader warehouse of books and service customers so much better that it's virtually impossible for anyone to try to compete with them. Even the Barnes and Nobles of the world have thrown in the towel. So while new technology, in the case of the internet, does increase new players and create new billionaires, it's not necessarily a purely competitive effect it has, too. It tends towards concentrated markets just as much as traditional capitalism does, if not because of the network effects, if not more so.
We're a little past our midpoint with Bob McChesney, host of Media Matters here on WILL, mention that again,
yeah,
and author of his latest book, Communication Revolution, Critical Junctures in the Future of Media, published by the New Press, coming up October 1st. We have one caller waiting and room for others if you want to join us, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Another Champagne listener next, line number two. Good morning.
Good morning. Could you tell us the status of the bill which was working its way through the Republican Congress to give Verizon and AT&T the right to set rates for all internet traffic? And I think the group that was opposed to that bill was called Net Neutrality. Am I right about that? And so I'm just wondering, what is the status of that bill, and how likely are we to maintain right now the free flow of information rather than have those two large corporations run the internet?
Well, thank you so much for that question, because that really is that's a home run over the center field wall right there in terms of a question. Hopefully I can get a single for the answer. The issue you refer to is called network neutrality. It's sort of a wonky term, but it basically means that all websites will be treated equally by the cable and phone companies that control 98% of the broadband web traffic in the United States, that they won't be able to discriminate and say, this website comes through really fast, that one comes through really slow, based on whether they pay us off, whether we like them for whatever reason. It would remove the power of the phone and cable companies to determine who gets to use their networks. And the idea of network neutrality was what the internet was built on. It grows out of common carriage, which is the law the telephone companies had. The telephone companies aren't allowed to discriminate who makes a phone call on their wires, and they've got to charge everyone the same rate. That was the deal that the government made with the phone company when it gave them a monopoly. It said, okay, you get a monopoly, but you can't discriminate against users. You've got to serve everyone at the same price. Well, that principle of the internet, that's why it exploded. It was a policy, not the technology. It was a policy that forced the phone companies to let any website to have equal crack at it. So my website got same play as Bill Gates' website or Rupert Murdoch's website. And that's what allowed the Googles and the Yahoos and the Amazons to flower. It was a free market, if you like economics. It was an open marketplace of ideas. Now, that's a great system for everyone in this country except for a couple of people, the people who own the cable and phone companies, who are seeing a huge revenue source before them that they'd love to get their mitts on. If they could somehow use their bottleneck of control over access to their systems to say, you pay me more if to get through on the fast lane, or else you go on the slow lane that takes a minute to download your site, good luck then. Well, that's a huge revenue source. And they've been chomping at the bit trying to get rid of network neutrality for a long time. And I want to just put this in context for my friends out there who are free market fans and who believe in free market capitalism. These companies, AT&T and Comcast and Verizon, are not free market companies. These are companies that wouldn't know free market if it kicked them in the butt. These are companies that are built on getting government monopoly telephone and cable franchises and not having competition. Their comparative advantage comes in buying and selling politicians and regulators, not serving the public. I mean, they've got piles of dissatisfied consumer complaints that no other industry in the country has that the phone and cable companies face. So they want to use their power with the politicians to allow them basically to privatize the internet. Say, okay, you guys, you know, we didn't build it, granted, but we've got the wires that the thing comes over. We want to take it, make it ours so we can determine who gets over and who doesn't. And that's what net neutrality is all about. And they were unfortunately successful to get the FCC to change it a few years ago. But they've been very careful about not trying to implement their sort of post-net neutrality world where they sort of cherry-pick the websites they like that come through quick. And there's a lot of money in this. Don't think it's just an abstract thing about repressing political websites. You know, if you want to book an air traffic or buy air travel or buy a book or do anything commercial on the internet, basically they're going to give them the power to which websites you're going to get really quickly can work with or which ones come through slowly unless they get a cut. So that's why there's so much at stake here. And right now there's a huge battle in Congress with a bill by Olympia Snowe, the Republican senator from Maine, and Byron Dorgan, the Democratic senator from North Dakota, trying to get net neutrality formally put in as the law of the land. And I think there's going to be a big push to make this get this through, to make this an issue in the 2008 election. All the Democratic candidates have come out squarely for net neutrality. The Bush administration, unfortunately, is, to be blunt, to use English in the way it was intended to be used, is in the pocket of the industry on this issue, especially AT&T. The people of this country across the political spectrum are in favor of network neutrality. This is not a left-right issue. Business community is in favor of this, except for two industries, the cable and phone companies. The NRA, you know, the Christian Coalition on the right, Code Pink and Move On on the left, and everyone in between. It really draws everyone together in this country as a sort of founding principle that you have a free and open internet and you don't allow a couple of corporations to cherry-pick which websites get through quickly and which don't. So it's a huge fight. If I urge people, if you care about this issue, and I'm sure you should, go to freepress.net, the website for the group Free Press I work on. And then there's another website, SaveTheInternet.com, which is the coalition Free Press organized with all the groups I just mentioned and literally hundreds of others, that stays right on top of this issue, and you can get involved. And, you know, the sort of, I think, local members of Congress, when they hear from people in their community how important this is, and this is to them, they change their votes, and we get their votes. And I urge you to contact both our senators, who are on record as being on the right side of this issue, and Representative Tim Johnson, if you live in the district.
Our lines are full. I want to go on and include some more callers. I hope the caller will forgive me for moving on. We're moving into our last 15, 20 minutes or so. We'll go next to a Champagne listener, line number 3. Good morning.
Hello?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I was interested, and I'm so pleased to have Dr. McChesney on, but when you say we had a critical juncture in journalism, I find that I saw this morning in USA Today that President Bush defended himself against Alan Greenspan's criticism, but he did it on Fox News, which is, of course, fair and balanced. And then I see how the media kind of manipulates us in cheering us on to the Iraq War, and then, of course, allowing us to look at OJ, OJ, OJ instead of real news. And I just find myself thinking that you passed the critical juncture and you're on the pathway to being what the founders totally would not want. What are your feelings about that?
Well, I think actually the critical juncture is what you're describing. I mean, I think the fact that so many Americans and working journalists basically share your disgust at what passes so often for journalism. And, you know, you don't get past it. You go through a critical juncture, but it doesn't get much worse. I mean, that being where we are now is what it is. And that the solution comes with what emerges out of this. And what we have to hope, in my view, emerges out of this is an aroused citizenry that demands that we have institutions put in place so our communities are covered. The real issues that matter in our lives do get covered. So politicians actually have to answer for the policies they're responsible for. They can't dance around them. They can't just go to cherry-picked media that know they're going to kiss their butts and dodge the tough questions that leaders in a democracy should be required to answer.
Well, thank you, because I hope at some point in time people like you can bring the media to what I consider its rightful place. Thank you, Professor.
Well, I appreciate your words.
Thanks for the call. We'll continue on. Someone in Urbana next on line number one. Good morning.
Hi. I remember you said something very early on about media depending on scarcity in a different way as a hamburger or a car.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to address that a little bit. I'm not sure that money is necessary for this game that you're talking about. And I want to give an example that before the Gutenberg Press came out, books cost as much as the average family farm. There was no law against copying them, simply because only the top 1% of the elite could either copy it or afford to pay a whole year's salary to a scribe to copy it. That monopoly was largely enforced by the Stationers Guild, and they obviously lost that monopoly when the Gutenberg Press came out, because in the first 50 years of the Gutenberg Press, more books were published than in all previous history, and the price went down to a fraction of a percent. Now, it took them over 250 years of lobbying by the Stationers Guild from around 1455 to 1710 to get that monopoly back. And that was in the form of our first copyright law, upon which all our current copyright law is based. Still, now almost 300 years later, after 1710, even though that law had been rejected for over 250 years from well before Henry VIII, to after Elizabeth and Mary Queen of Scots and the King James Bible, you know, I have named after her son and stuff. Now up to the present day. The same thing's happening now in the form of e-books. There are already millions of books on the Internet, freely downloadable, in over 100 languages, and more of these books are being created in the first 50 years of Internet popularity than ever were published in all previous history. And nobody's charging any money for most of those books. So I think that that this media depends on scarcity thing may be under some more stress than you take into account. Comments?
Well, yeah, I don't think I made myself clear. My point about scarcity was, in fact, that media doesn't have traditional scarcity, that you could have multiple users of the same product simultaneously, many people read the same book, and it wouldn't detract from the ability of the person reading the first book. It was the opposite point I was trying to make.
Well, I thought the point you made was that's why the copyright monopoly was necessary.
Well, the copyright was written up as a way to protect content providers so that other people couldn't produce their work and make money off it, and they wouldn't get enough money, so they'd have incentive to keep producing work in the future.
I think you'll have to do some more research on that.
Well, I've done my share, but I mean, that principle holds today exactly.
It wasn't the copyright providers, it was the publishers. That first 14-year period went to the publishers only. And the author only got the copyright if they were still alive after 14 years. It wasn't inheritable.
No. Well, I don't I think we have a – I've done my share work. I think we're getting way off the track here. I think the important point for today is that those concerns about copyright actually are magnified in the Internet issue era.
Oh, I agree.
And that was the point I was making, which is that now that the distribution of work is almost free and instantaneous and global, theoretically and soon practically, the concern of authors not getting return on their work and creating a system where they can be compensated is still a major concern, if not more so than ever, but also the concern that we have onerous laws created by powerful media corporations to put barbed wire all over the Internet to make it very difficult for fair use in the public domain to exist is a much larger concern also. That was the point I was making.
Now, those two points you just made seem contradictory, that the authors need to have this compensation and that the big corporations have created what you termed as a relatively permanent copyright. And the Supreme Court decision certainly says they can make it permanent. Once you make copyright permanent, the public domain's pretty much history.
No, I agree completely, and I'm not defending that. If I gave any sense that I thought that was the way things should go, I was not speaking properly. I think that's wrong. I think we very much have to protect the ability of people who produce content to make a living, and I think that was the spirit that guides the justification for copyright. I think at the same time, We can't have a system that creates the bar copyright to such an extent that it's property rights that really inhibit the eliminate the public domain and inhibit fair use and really undermine the genius of the internet. That's my point all along.
Okay. Hope the caller will forgive me, but we're moving into our last 10 minutes, and I have another caller I want to include in our conversation. Our guest is Bob McChesney. He is the host of Media Matters here on WILL AM, Sundays at 1 p.m. Central Time. Also author of numerous books, including his latest, Communication Revolution, Critical Junctures, and the Future of Media, to be published October 1st by the New Press. If you want to join our conversation, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-9455. We have someone waiting in Will County on line number 4 next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm going to make the setup to this question real short, and let's see if I can get the point across. I despair in imagining there is enough popular expectation for an objective source of information. In other words, rather than the internet and the digital revolution democratizing, I would say it commodifies information. Information is all alike. It's governed by price. Quality is not a measure. A vast majority of readers want lots of information at no price. As long as it's free, it's good. The single good is free. Measures of quality are passé. The notion that media is a voice, is a mouthpiece for interests, is perfectly accepted. And the notion that there is a reservoir of objective, critical information is anachronous. These are notions I get from the milieu I travel in. Please tell me it's not that bad.
Yeah, it's not that bad. I have good news for you. I understand why you feel that way, and I can see there'd certainly be evidence looking at society a certain way that that's what you would see. I see that too, but at the same time, what I see that's very heartening at a whole bunch of different levels is people who reject that and are either trying to do good media themselves or, more importantly, in the area I work in, are organizing to try to create a better media system, creating policies and institutions that will produce that system and protect the good stuff we have now and enhance stuff our media system to make it much better in the future. And one of the striking features, and I write about it in this book, it's a big chunk of the book, the final half, in fact, has been the truly remarkable development in the past 5 years in the United States of a media reform movement, of people who've said this is a really important issue. We can't afford to just let AT&T and commercial interests and lobbyists behind closed doors determine the future of our communication system, because if we do, they're going to make it to suit their interests, not ours. And they're using our subsidies, they're making policies in our name without our informed consent. And literally hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of Americans have gotten together in issues of media ownership, public broadcasting, stopping government and corporate propaganda masquerading as news, protecting network neutrality, ending the digital divide, crucial public policy issues. And it's been an astonishing development, and it's been unprecedented, at least for the past 100 years in the United States, or 80 years. And it's had a tremendous effect. For the first time in my lifetime, regulators at the FCC, politicians in Congress, actually care what people say in these issues. They don't just seek their counsel from corporate lobbyists. And we're having an effect on them, and I think it's going to show up eventually, if we're successful, in the type of media system and the type of society we live in.
Very interesting. I just don't see it in the rank and file, and I applaud the policy planning you're making, but I fear that you are doing policy planning on a who cares issue. Me and you and six other people care.
Well, you know, that's what everyone thought, including me, 10 years ago. And what's striking is that's not the case. What we found out is that when you actually approached Americans and said, you know, you don't just have to be a consumer. You actually are a citizen and a participant. This media system isn't the natural free market system. It's a system built on policies and subsidies made in your name without your informed consent. Your children don't have to be marinated in advertising. You're entitled to know what's going on in your community with real journalism. When people understand that it's their right and even their responsibility as citizens, they get it. A lot of them do. It's been one of the really heartening developments of this movement in the last 5 years.
Well, one of the things you address in your new book, as a matter of fact, communication revolution is the issue of media scholarship. And the criticism that you raise is that for so long it just simply wasn't relevant.
Well, the field of communication that I'm in. Well, you know, I think what's happened is that the field of communication over the last couple of decades has sort of settled into a niche on campus doing certain types of work. And we've seen at the same time this communication revolution, the digital revolution, the internet, and all these developments. So everyone understands information and communication play a much larger role in our lives. But the field of communication hasn't really caught up with it yet. And it hasn't really caught up with the sort of political moment we're in, which is sort of the defining moment for our field. But too many of our scholars are really not unaware of it or oblivious to it. And they, you know, they're going to wait 20 years and do a postmortem on it maybe. And my point in the book is that that's not really the way we have to go. We need scholars on deck working on the issues that citizens care about, doing research on the issues, understanding the moment we're in. The assumptions that so many communication scholars have had in the United States, like many Americans since I've been in academia, that commercial broadcasting was the natural American way, that professional journalism works, that objectivity is the type of journalism we should have. All these assumptions really, whether you like them or not, they're not holding anymore. The thing is changing. We are in a critical juncture. And we can't just, if we hold on like to reads, to these old ideas and say, well, I want them to be true if I keep holding to them, that won't make them true. We've got to recognize the situation we're in and adjust our scholarship accordingly. And there's a crucial role for media scholars and communication scholars to play addressing these issues, coming up with hard research on some of these questions and engaging with the general population on the issues that so many Americans really do care about but aren't getting any assistance from scholars at this point.
So as a communication scholar, as a media, somebody who studies media and its impact, what would be a good agenda?
Well, I actually outline at the end of the book. Yeah. I mean, I think there's areas we need to research, and I'm hopeful. I mean, there are a handful of universities in the United States that are taking leadership. I'm delighted to say Illinois is one of them, University of Southern California, Penn, Michigan. A few others, NYU, have really stepped up and said, you know, we're going to incorporate communication policy in a broad sense and understanding what's going on in the digital revolution into the heart and soul of our research. And I think that's going to have an effect on the whole field. But I wrote this book partially sort of to say to the other folks in the field, you know, we've got a really tremendous opportunity here to take advantage of, to make our research relevant, to make the stuff we care about really important to a lot of people. Let's not blow it, because right now it looks like we're blowing it.
The other thing that I observed, we just have about maybe 4 minutes left, so we probably can't talk about this in great depth, but I'm sure you see the same thing. When I, you know, occasionally, you know, lecture in classes, journalism classes, so forth, and talk to young people about how they're using media and what their habits are, you know, they're vastly different from my generation, vastly different. They're not watching television as much, or they're watching it in very different ways. They never listen to radio. You know, they're constantly with their cell phone or their iPod, and if they're watching television news, it's The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, basically. So this is, you know, this whole the behavior of college age and younger kids is a mystery to people in the media industry, and I can say that from talking with many of them.
That's right. And if you, you know, I teach a very large undergraduate class every year here at the University of Illinois. And you know, I have 400-some students, and I'll ask them, how many of you read a daily newspaper every day? And you know, when I was in college at that age in the early 1970s, I mean, I was reading two papers a day. Granted, it was the sports section in one of them, but still it was a newspaper, and I had to trot through the front section to get to the sports. Okay. Today, though, I think, you know, and that was standard then. I mean, you felt like you had to know what was going on in the world, and that's how you found out about it. And today, you know, the number of hands that goes up, precious few. I mean, it's simply, and if you're a newspaper publisher today, I'm sure you're scared to death. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really say, what is our future here? That's a sign of the critical juncture we're in. I mean, that's why I'm saying, even if you love the status quo, even if you think everything is wonderful, hunky-dory about the world, that's not an option. The world is changing. The question is how it's going to change. Are we going to sit back? The choice is to sit back and let AT&T and Comcast and Verizon and News Corporation and General Electric, behind closed doors with the politicians they basically own and they subsidize, draw up the new plans for their vision of the world and their vision of where journalism will be and commercialism and advertising and who controls what, or whether we're going to say, hey, it's our system. We're the one who subsidized it. We're the ones who made these guys rich. We should make the policies that are made in our name with our informed consent. And that's what the battle's all about.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I'll just mention for folks again the book, Communication Revolution, Critical Junctures and the Future of Media, about to be published by the New Press. I believe it is out October 1st, and the author is our guest, Robert W. McChesney. We call him Bob McChesney around here. Also,
yeah, we downplay the W nowadays.
Okay. The host of Media Matters on WILL AM every Sunday at 1 p.m., and you can also catch the podcast, the archives on our website, will.illinois.edu. And Bob McChesney, thanks so much for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Jack.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 25th anniversary of offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana. Bodywork Associates now has an office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Institute has now established the Center for Men and Masculinity, aimed at research, clinical services, and education about boys and men. Information at menandmasculinity.com.
That's it for Focus 580 this morning. Time to hand things off to Tom Rogers, hosting the Afternoon Magazine.
Good morning, Jack, and hosting the noon hour of the Afternoon Magazine at 106. I turn the microphone over to Bill Hammack, our guest host for the 1 o'clock hour. He'll be talking to a developmental biologist with Princeton University, John Tyler, who has written a book called Why Size Matters, From Bacteria to Blue Whales. We'll hear about that book coming up in the 1 o'clock hour. After our look at news over the noon hour from NPR, the BBC, and AM 580, let's look at the commodity markets at the moment. Big drop today in the wheat market, about a 20-cent drop or more. In both Kansas City and Chicago, the corn's modestly up, the beans a bit down. Let's go from the top in Kansas City. The nearby December wheat contract is currently trading at 828 and three, down 20 and a half cents at the moment. In Chicago, December wheat's trading at 846, down 23 cents. The March contract, 851 and a half, down 21. In the corn pit, we see the December trading at 354 and three quarters, up 2.5 cents. The March at 371 and a quarter, up 2.5, or 2.25 rather. May corn right now at 381 and a quarter, up 2.25. Down day on the bean market for the moment. November is trading at 963.5, down 6 cents. January down 5.5 at 979. March beans are at 987, down 5. January of, 08. We were giving the January of 08 contract at 979 a bushel. That's down 5.5 cents. In the products, October soybean meal is currently trading at 265.60. That's down 80 at the moment. October bean oil at 39.16, down 32. Feeder cattle for September right now trading at 116.05. That's up 2.5 cents. The lean hog contract for October at 63.65 a hundredweight, down 22.5. Crude oil at the moment in New York for the October contract is up 14 cents now, trading at 81.65. The CRB index is at 328.22, up 335. The U.S. dollar index is up 21 right now at 79.38. The gold contract for October up 550 an ounce at 722.50. And on Wall Street, the Dow is up another 100 points, almost 101. I'll check that, 104 points now at 13,843. The NASDAQ is up 23 at 2674, and the S&P 500 index is up 13.5 points at 1533. That's our look at the commodity markets. The next market update comes your way at 1258 Central Time. And, of course, a reminder, you can hear all the market activity and other agricultural news items on the closing market report at 206 Central Time.